And welcome to our session on Jazz Radio in D.C., a tribute to the late Felix Grant. And we have a very esteemed panel here to pay tribute to Felix and talk about his legacy. I would like to introduce the moderator of the session, David Sager. And David is a D.C. native who's been a professional trombonist for 32 years, 12 of which were spent in New Orleans, which I guess counts double. And he currently works at the Library of Congress in the Recorded Sound Division of Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division. He's also included with involved with the Sony Jukebox Project and co-producer of the CD reissue King Oliver Off the Record, which was nominated for a Grammy this past year. So without further ado, I would like to turn things over to David and the panel. And we will have time for questions at the end of the session.
Thank you, Roberta. Am I audible now?
Yes.
This is kind of weird. Don't need these. It was the good fortune of Washington, D.C. area residents to have for some 40 years the on-air presence of Felix Grant. For nearly 30 of those years, Grant's program, The Album Sound, was heard Monday through Friday between 8 p.m. and midnight over WMAL AM 63. Grant generally presented selections from newly recorded and released jazz LPs, and also frequently featured early jazz on recently reissued albums. He spoke of both contemporary and earlier styles with great reverence and authority. Grant, in his polished baritone, spoke quickly and articulately, making the most of the limiting commercial AM format. And he also went to the trouble to articulate his impressions of musical essence, or to speak about the often difficult creative processes and challenging lives a jazz musician had to endure. For a non-musician, Grant did this with great sensitivity and understanding. This was one of Felix's great contributions to jazz programming and broadcasting, this making aware to his audience the musician's artistic mind. I should also mention that he was a champion for live jazz and constantly plugged local live engagements by visiting local and visiting musicians. Now, as diverse as his tastes were, Grant made no secret of his deep love for the music of Brazil, and featured it regularly. And it has been said that he played an important role in introducing the bossa nova to this country. And we will talk about that a little bit. Time to get up. One of the great testimonies to Grant's popularity was in 1979 when WMAL, in the midst of a format change, decided to remove Grant from the air. Public outcry was enormous, and within 2 weeks, he was restored to his time slot, 8 p.m. to midnight, five nights a week, where he remained for several more years. Felix Grant not only captured the attention of jazz fans, but also helped tune the ears of budding musicians as well. I, for one, was an avid listener and was turned in many positive directions thanks to the late Felix Grant. Now, I'd like to introduce the panel. Judith Corey is a professor of music at the University of the District of Columbia, where she serves as music program director in the Department of Mass Media, Visual, and Performing Arts. And she is the curator of the Felix E. Grant Jazz Archive, the university's Jazz and Research and Resource Center. And to Judith's right is Michael Turpin, who has been a recording engineer at the Library of Congress since 1981, specializing in audio preservation and also in live and studio recording. He is currently in charge of recording the Music Division's concert series at the library's Coolidge Auditorium and running the Library of Congress's Jefferson Building recording studio. He also has a recording studio at his home and is a consultant, and he worked on the Felix Grant collection in the collaboration with the University of the District of Columbia. Right here to my right is Bill Mayhew, who for many years was as close to Felix Grant as 12 midnight is to 11:59 p.m. Bill began his radio career on WFAX in Falls Church, Virginia. Can you say what year that was?
1949.
And subsequently, he was heard in over the station WPIK from Alexandria, Virginia, before moving to WMAL and to Dumont TV. After a stint on WOL, he returned to WMAL and remained there for 30 years, doing the midnight to 6 a.m. shift. Bill left radio broadcasting in 1993. In addition to jazz broadcasting, he has also been the host for the Redskins Sundays, 12 years, right? Mm-hmm. And for the Kemper Golf Show for 11 years.
And the Leukemia
Radiothon, I should add, for 22 years. And two individuals from the left is Rusty Hassan, who began his radio career in the 1960s at Georgetown University, 1916, over WGTB. He broadcasted also over WAMU from the mid-1970s to 1987 before going to the now defunct WDCU at the University of the District of Columbia, and then began broadcasting over DC's Pacifica station WPFW 89.3 FM in 1987, where he continues today with Monday Night Jazz, sometimes known as Jazz and More, I think. Rusty also teaches jazz history at the University of Maryland University College, also has taught at American University, the JCC, and the Smithsonian. And he spends his days at the American Federation of Government Employees. And finally, on the far end of the, next to finally, sorry, at the end of the dais is Robert Bamberger, better known as Rob Bamberger, who has been the host of Hot Jazz Saturday Night on Washington, D.C. public radio affiliate WAMU-FM. The three-hour program is devoted principally to jazz, swing, and popular music from the 1920s through the 1940s. For nearly 10 years, Rob's program has been syndicated internationally over NPR worldwide. Now, but not least, is Larry Applebaum, who has been the host of The Sound of Surprise over WPFW since 1981. He is presently a music reference librarian and jazz specialist at the Library of Congress, where for many years he has been a sound engineer. Larry is known for his writings in Jazz Times and as the person who discovered the Thelonious Monk John Coltrane Carnegie Hall tapes, which eventually saw a triumphant reissue on Blue Note Records. Before we open up conversation with the panel, I would like for you all to hear an excerpt from Felix Grant broadcast to get an idea of what the show sounded like as it began. This excerpt with where Felix is having a conversation with trumpeter Clark Terry is from circa 1966.
Yes, this is the way we begin the program. Well, obviously the song is Tenderly, but specifically tonight we have the good fortune of having the gentleman by with us who plays that just magnificent horn, who's I suppose an individual we've talked about as much as anyone I can think of here on the program, highlighting his great taste and many things along that particular area. Clark Terry, it's a joy to welcome you here to WMAL.
Thank you very, very kindly, Felix.
And it's always great to know that you're in Washington. I know with the kind of schedule that you have in New York, I'm amazed you're even able to... Well, you're from St. Louis.
Yes.
Born and raised in St. Louis?
Born and raised in St. Louis, yes.
What are some of the early days of Clark Terry in St. Louis?
Oh, I played in St. Louis with a very... locally famous group, a guy by the name of Dollar Bill and his Small Change.
Oh.
And I was one of the pennies, of course.
Did you have uniforms or something?
Oh, man, did we ever.
I have some books at home, Clark, and I know you've seen them. Of course, you've been in the business and traveling.
Yeah.
One of the tremendous kicks I got of looking out of some of the earlier bands were the variety of costumes, I might almost call them, beyond uniforms, some of the people had at one time. Everything from kilts to white tie and white tails.
Yeah, I was always one to try to stay up with the styles, even back in the days when they had the zoot suits, the 30-inch knees and 16-inch bottoms.
Yes.
We used to have bottoms so tight that people used to wonder how we got them on. We had to grease our ankles.
Ankles, yes. Forget it, the shoes had to come off. No.
Oh,
way.
Yeah.
Any other people in the family?
Musicians?
Brothers or sisters?
My brother-in-law, my oldest sister's husband, was a tuba player in the best band in St. Louis, Dewey Jackson's Musical Ambassadors.
Yes.
He was the one who got me started in the whole scene. I used to sit around and watch them rehearse at my sister's home. The way I got connected with the trumpet was that when they would take coffee breaks or whatever kind of breaks they took in those days, the trumpet player would always ask me to watch my horn, son. And I would watch it, and one day he came back, and I was sneaking a little note out on it.
Oh.
And he said, son, that was a good sound. You're going to be a trumpet player. And, of course, I was stupid enough to believe him.
Well, now, what year would this be, Clark, about?
This was,
I'm just trying to get an idea of the sort of thing that was going on at the time. Okay, I'm hip. I think maybe our guest here
is... You don't think I'm going to tell my age, do you?
Yes. Like someone was asking me at lunchtime today. And I said, one of the favorite answers, they say, well, how old are you? I said, plenty old. Plenty old. And when they asked the second time, I say, I told you the first time. Now what else are we talking about? After all, radio here is a great illusion, you know.
Right.
I think we ought to have a little music with our guest here to show off it.
Judith, I would like to ask you to tell us a little bit about Felix and about the Felix E. Grant Jazz Archive.
Tell you a little bit about Felix. Felix was a radio broadcaster, I think, as you all know, in this area for over 45 years. He began his career on WWDC in 1945 and was there until 1953 when he went over to WMAL, where he had a long-standing career of about 30 years. Most people remember him for the album Sound, which ran 2 weeks short of 30 years, where he introduced music, jazz. He called his show The Album Sound, and there's a reason for why he did this. I don't want to spend too much time because I know that we have a lot to talk about, but as I think David said, when they tried to remove him from the air in 1979, there was a great outcry in the city. He was brought back until 1983 and then was finally, left the station. He was fired from the station, actually, and then went to WRC. He finished his career at the University of the District of Columbia. He was there from 1987 until his death in 1993. Actually, how he became part and how he was introduced to the university, in 1987, there was a citywide committee that was formed to form a celebration for Duke Ellington in April of 1987. And several people from the university were on that committee. Calvin Jones, who was head of our jazz studies program, Robert Felder, and Edith Smith, who was at WDCU, the general manager. And she offered, she wanted Felix to come over to the station, and he did. He did his Saturday show, The World of Jazz, on WDCU until his death in 1993. And I think this is a wonderful opportunity, really, to provide more information about the archives and about the other collections that are housed there, and also some of the current and future projects that we're involved in, all of which are directly or indirectly related to Felix Grant's decision back in 1988 to give his collection to the university. He was very generous. I mean, through interviews, Felix said that he gave over 50,000 recordings over the years to a variety of institutions and individuals. To the Lorton Prison, he gave them to the D.C. Public Library. He gave also to our radio station, he gave about 2,000 albums, and this was outside of what his entire collection that went to the university. Now, of this collection of the LPs, CDs, well, of course, were these wonderful interviews that no one else has that are unique that he did primarily on WMAL. And I listened to an interview that he did, I guess, surely in 1989, where he was so concerned that the condition of the tapes, who would listen to them, would they be available to people in the future, because he didn't know, was someone going to transcribe them, because at this time he knew he gave them to the university, but I think he would be very pleased to know that they are now available to everyone. After his death, I must make mention of this. In 1993, when after Mr. Felder retired, he sort of initiated the efforts to establish the archives at the university. The archives was put under the direction of the Jazz Studies Program, which is with the College of Arts and Sciences and also with the Learning Resources Division. At that point, Calvin Jones called Reuben Jackson, who then introduced us to Larry Applebaum, who we wanted to come in as a consultant. Now, Larry was, I hope I don't embarrass you by saying this, Larry was very busy at the time, but because he loved the idea of the archives, and he also was a personal friend of Felix and June Grant, he came on a Saturday, spent the whole day with us, and gave us a consultantship to give us a scope of work for free. This is how we got started, really. And through Larry, he introduced us to Michael Turpin, who initially, we knew that what we had to deal with first, of course, were the interviews, because they were so wonderful and we wanted people to hear them. This was back before you could, digitize anything. Yeah, before digital. So he suggested that Mike work with us in transferring most of them were reel-to-reel tapes, and back then we just put them on cassettes. At that time, I think the protocol was still at the library to do reel-to-reel, wasn't it? Yeah, reel-to-reel format. So we put them on cassettes because we really didn't have and Mike handled all of that. They became available inside, and then in 2000, we had a project this is after we were for web delivery. Michael came back to us as well then and sort of set up the system design for that. They were digitized online, and then in conjunction with the WRLC, which is the Washington Research Library Consortium, of which we are a part and is a wonderful asset for the university, we were able to have web delivery, and we've gone on since then. Mrs. Grant continued to donate many, many other materials, very important archival materials, which are now part of the digital collection that you can access online through the university's archives website. And over the years, we've grown a lot of individual collectors. Dennis Askey, who was a personal friend, there's just many, many things. You can find out most information. I don't want to take up too much time because I know you want to go on to other things, but if you check out the website, you'll see the number of collections that we have here now. Unfortunately, when WDCU very stupidly was sold because of the budget cuts in the university had to absorb some of these, the financial situation that the city was in at the time, and that was in 1997, and they sold the radio station, and this was a great loss for us. However, all of the materials that were in WDCU are in the archives now. The sound recordings, a lot of the archival materials are now part of that collection, so we have made sure that that was taken care of. And pretty much a lot of the same materials that Felix had are not duplicated, but the same types of materials are there. And then in addition to individual collectors, I think because of the reputation of Felix Grant and also the reputation of our jazz studies program and also Calvin Jones, we've gotten many, many donations. We don't have to really have an active acquisition policy right now. People usually come to us. Paul Anthony just in 2006 gave over 5,100 albums, LPs to the university. So we're in a wonderful position as far as accepting those. We now have the state-of-the-art facility, I want to say. that's temperature controlled. We have compact shelving. This was done with capital improvement funds from the the district. So we are showcased really at the university, and I consider it one of the great treasures. We also are very closely aligned with the Jazz Studies Performance Program, and I consider this a very, very important part of it because I want this to be a living center. It's not a museum piece. I mean, we very actively have outreach. We promote, along with the Jazz Studies Program, concerts, workshops, lots of activities. We work in conjunction with our cable TV station so that we can record this. We also house the information that documents the Jazz Studies program and supports the curriculum there. So this is all a very, very important part of it. And I invite you all to visit us either online or in person. I know we had two wonderful visitors yesterday, Vincent and Stephen. They came and we really enjoyed their visit, and we encourage you all to come. Please visit us online and listen to the interviews. They're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Aren't they great?
Yeah.
Okay, so any other questions after, I'm more than willing to answer, but I know we are very limited in time, and I know we have some other things to talk about.
A little bit more about the archive. I want to ask Mike, you were in a fun position to be in, to get to work on the Felix Grant collection, particularly since you are a native to the area, and I think you listened to a few of Felix's broadcasts when you were growing up, did you not?
I did, yeah. Being a D.C. native, I grew up in a pretty musical household. My aunt lived with us. She was a piano teacher and a big jazz fan, and when she would get done playing or practicing, we'd put some records on, and then when we got tired of those, we'd listen to Felix Grant in the evening, and the album Sound Till Midnight. It was.
Were you allowed to stay up past midnight and hear the Bill Mayhew show?
I was just saying to Bill that when I came in, he kept me up a lot of nights.
Yeah, okay.
Past my bedtime.
The one.
I was the one, yeah. But I'm sure there were many more than one. It was just working on this collection was just a great experience for me. And
are there some particular challenges that you found in preserving these tapes that weren't really a formal studio tapes or off
right.
the board? Some of them were pretty ad hoc, I think.
They were. There weren't too many problems as I recall. I think the tapes were in pretty good shape. We were fortunate in that regard that they didn't have to use the oven. Yeah, we didn't. I don't recall having maybe just a handful that needed baking or any kind of special attention. But they were in pretty good shape.
Mostly open reel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you know how Felix recorded these various interview excerpts we're going to be hearing today? And they're different, varying quality as far as their timbre and gain and all. Do you know how he?
I really don't have any details about that. I mean, I assume most of them were recorded in the studio. I don't know how, who the engineer was or what the techniques were.
Well,
but
chime in as we play some things
whenever
you feel the
okay.
need. And before we open up conversation with our radio hosts and our radio host emeritus, I'd like to play for you another excerpt from one of Felix's interviews. This is with pianist Dorothy Donegan. I think this is the 1993 interview. There are two with Dorothy Donegan. This one is a little bright, so you may want to adjust it.
In your starting days, the people who would come into Chicago were pretty well-established individuals, and I guess it could be a little intimidating for a woman playing piano, and there weren't all that many women playing that actively.
Well, I used to hear a woman who was very good named Cleo Brown play.
Oh, I heard about her.
She really had a terrific left hand, and so I would go to the parlor, which I used to, what everybody called it, the dump, and for 10 cents, and I would hear Cleo Brown play.
Matter of fact, the only reason I know about her, Dave Brubeck made a very special point of saying that he considered her one of his major influences and wrote a piece titled Cleo Brown. I'd never heard her. I've never heard her on record even. I don't even know if she recorded. I suppose she may have.
Oh, yes, and she recorded a number called The Stuff Is Here. And she could play Boogie Woogie. And then I used to hear Art Tatum. Roselle Gale used to bring him up to my house in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he used to come up to my house and hear me play. And I was very flattered, you know, and he would take me under his wing, and, you know, he would have me play very softly. Because he said the softer you played, the faster you could play.
Mm-hmm. One time when Bobby Hackett was by here, he was talking about playing softly. He said, and Bobby was a very little you know, short little guy, and he had this big, heavy voice, and he said, it's hard to play easy. You know, he meant, you know, exactly you're saying, play soft. He said that was the difficult thing to do.
Yeah, well, Bobby Hackett got me my first Capitol recording contract, and he would tell his men, don't get a home run, just get on base. See, if you play too hard, we'll get an encore, and then we'll have to work too hard.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, don't get a home run, just get on base.
Oh, talking about Bobby Hackett with Dorothy Donegan here. How in the world did this...
Talking about these things on the air and on AM radio back then, it boggles my mind. He not only was playing great music five nights a week, but discussing these intricacies of making music as to how to play with greater velocity and play more quietly and not as loudly, and this was coming from somebody who wasn't a musician himself, and I think that's just was one of the really magical things about listening to Felix Grant. Now, Bill, you and Felix were on AM commercial radio and had pretty much the free range as to the kind of musical selections that you broadcasted. And could you tell us a little bit about that, about being on AM radio in those days, and how things have changed, and about the differences in the repertoire you and Felix had? Was there some kind of a line drawn in the sand, or
nothing intentional? It's just his taste in music was a bit different than mine. But let me just for a moment mention the story about Bobby Hackett. Yeah. Okay, he had come to Washington at the time that Jackie Gleason had just finished conducting two gorgeous 33 1/3 albums of mood music. And in an interview on WMAL, I said to Bobby, I said, "What kind of a conductor was Jackie Gleason?" And he said, "Let me tell you, Bill, he couldn't conduct traffic through the Holland Tunnel at 3 a.m. in the morning." Felix was a fun guy. I always felt that he kept his fun part kind of under control on the air. And I would get in the car and I would drive in and I would obviously listen to him, and if I got there early I would hear him while I was in the studio waiting to go on at midnight. Yet when you got Felix out of that situation, like I said to Felix one time, "What do you do when you get off the air?" He said, "Oh, I go down to Bobby Abbo's place there on Connecticut Avenue and have a taste or two." I said, "You do?" I said, "What do you do after that?" He says, "Well, I usually go home. If I want to read something, I do, but I probably get ready and go to bed." I don't know why I asked him, but I said, "Do you wear pajamas?" And in all seriousness, he said, "Of course I do." And then I said, "What color?" And it was like he was insulted. He said, "White, of course."
This was on the air, you asked,
yeah.
It, right?
I did an interview with each of the performers on WMAL. I was at MAL twice. I got fired when a man named Fred Howing took over the station, and any of us who had individual contracts, he decided he wanted to do something for the Evening Star, which owned it, and he fired all the contract performers. Martin Agronsky, Bryson Rash, Jim Gibbons, Milton Q. Ford, myself, Jay Perry, marvelous sports announcer named Steve Gilmartin. We all got axed. And I went over to WOL and stayed for 10 years from 54 to 64, and went back to MAL in 1964 and stayed there until I got canned in 1993. Be honest with me. How many of you never heard me on the radio? No wonder.
From out of town.
No wonder I got fired, huh? Fired 9 times, but I haven't a complaint in the world. And Felix and I had a wonderful association. We didn't socialize often, but once in a while we would be at the Kennedy Center on stage together to introduce some big band or some jazz artist who was in town. I have some wonderful remembrances of those from pictures that were taken of that. Felix was a Coast Guard hero, I am told, and was quite honored. Never talked about it. Never said a word to me about his experiences in the Coast Guard. But I liked him. We got along great together. And I'm a lucky man to have known him as long as I have.
And you had free range as far as what you programmed on
WMAL? Absolutely. I was allowed to play what I want, say what I want, interview whomever I wished, and the management supported that. A man named Andy Ockershausen, call him Andy O, he was my boss. And I not only did the all-night midnight to 6, I did for 12 years a Redskin Sunday show, which was a 2-hour talk show from the top of the Key Bridge Marriott. And I did that for 12 years. After 10 years, I moved out in front of the stadium to do it. And I had the Leukemia Radiothon for 22 years, which I hosted the whole 24 hours. Radio for me was fun. I know it's changed a lot, but to be able to go to work and, as I say, play what you want, say what you want, interview whomever you wished, and they supported you, that was a pretty lucky thing. And I'm convinced that if you love what you do, it is not work. And I sit before you at age 81, if I could go back on the air and be Bill Mayhew, man, I'd do it in a minute. I think I'd pay somebody to put me back on the air.
Well, see what we can do.
Well, okay.
I want to address our 3 current radio hosts.
Okay.
Please chime in where you feel the urge. Gentlemen, ? In as much as you all are carrying on Felix Grant's work here in D.C. by doing such fine jobs of hosting and programming, I want to ask you not only about your memories of Felix Grant and the way he influenced you, but also about your on-air methodologies. And do you all have a particular way that you define your repertoire as far as what you will play and what you won't play on the air? What sort of what are the boundaries of your repertoire? That's one of the areas I wanted to discuss. And please feel free to just to take this also to particular memories about Felix Grant and the ways that he may have influenced these decisions of yours.
Okay, I'll start off. I'm Rusty Hassan, host of Monday Night Jazz and WPFW. And I first heard Felix Grant when I came to Washington as a student at Georgetown in 1963. I was already a jazz fan and had a few records in my collection, and I was really fortunate at Georgetown, after being a student there for a few years, to stumble in doing a radio show on WGTB circa 1965 or 66. And I guess it was really later on in 1968-69 when I met my then wife, whose father was a jazz pianist, a good friend of John Malachi's from the 40s, who really demonstrated to me the impact that Felix Grant had, because he was, I guess, in many ways, the common vehicle that many people from out of town got an introduction to Felix Grant, because he was a cab driver. And he drove a cab every night, and of course he was listening to Felix Grant and the album sound. And that goes through decades of the 50s and 60s and so on, in terms of the impact that Felix had. When I started broadcasting, I was sort of a pioneer in a way, because I was on FM radio, just as FM is becoming the vehicle for music, and indeed the album sound, because when I started broadcasting, I would do frequently whole sides of an album. And one way that I've changed over the years was I was very much into the avant-garde back in 1967, and I would play, say, free jazz by Ornette Coleman, and then Ascension by John Coltrane, you know, do them back to back, and really revel in the three phone calls that I got, you know. And I've scaled back in terms of the avant-garde pieces that I would play. Even well, now I'd still cover the new music and really applaud the way WPFW does champion contemporary artists. The group that Larry Applebaum's been a part of for many years, Transparent Productions, bringing in cutting-edge music. And I think we've all learned how to tailor our programming in terms of presenting the real cutting edge, but make it accessible to a broader audience. And that's a real challenge. Uh-huh. I got to work with Felix at WDCU. And now Felix was reveling in his freedom. Boy, I can play pieces 6 minutes long. You know, he didn't have the commercial restraints, but he was still very, very programmed to playing a piece, talk before and after, not getting into segueing pieces the way Larry and Rob and I all have done over decades, which has become the, sort of the standard. But Felix was very much still, even on WDCU, thinking in terms of along the lines of how he programmed for many years. And again, I think we could all, though, really talk about how we learned how to interview artists, making artists feel relaxed, feel comfortable getting into that groove with them that Felix did. I think we've all learned from that. And I got, in knowing Felix at WDCU, also knew him when he was going through his final illness from being treated for cancer. I would see Felix during the week. Well, how are you doing? I feel terrible. You know, and his voice would be raspy, you know, from the chemo. Yeah. And then I'd hear him on Saturday, and it was that melodious voice we just heard from the 60s. I mean, he just was focusing in on living to do his show on Saturdays. And he said, Rusty, I'm hoping I want to make it for 50 years. He didn't do it. He came close. Huh. And it was a marvelous run, to say the least.
Wow.
Turn it over to Rob, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Here.
My show originally was somewhat narrowly defined. It has changed some over the years. I very strictly kept to jazz and swing bands and didn't drift too far from the period of the 1920s through 40s. And then I had an unusual experience in the mid-80s when I was at a meeting of the International Association of Jazz Record Collectors. And it was the first time I'd ever had a chance to meet George Buck, who's a remarkable individual, sightless, who acquired radio stations and in 1949 began his own label, Jazzology. And to help him out, pianist Art Hodes and cornetist Wild Bill Davison essentially pulled together bands and agreed to record for him, I'm sure, at a fractional cost of their usual charges. George acquired a number of labels and catalogs over the years, hundreds and hundreds of releases. So we were sitting at lunch and he asked me what I played and I basically replied what I just told you a moment ago. And he looked at me, still sightless, but he looked towards me and said, "Do you mean to tell me that by virtue of an accident of birth, you don't play anything after 1945? The scales fell from my eyes. And I've never forgotten that. And so over the years, I've become very interested in repertory jazz, which has been fascinating now for 30 years. These are bands that are based on historic models such as the Creole Jazz Band with the two cornet front line, musicians that do not play slavishly to the historic records, but musicians who are so immersed in the styles that they're able to strip away 50 to 80 years of stylistic changes and play in the manner of with an originality that is incredibly compelling. And I've drifted into some of the more recent recordings, labels like Arbor's, where you have musicians who are well-versed and grounded in historic styles. And I have featured some of those, and I have drifted into the 1910s, thanks to Archaeophone, to try to make the point that recordings from the 19-aughts and 1910s aren't silly and lack sophistication. Some of the lyrics of those early songs are devilishly, fiendishly clever. And so over the years, it has broadened. And bear in mind, and I'm sure this is true, something that Larry and Rusty can relate to. In my case, there's 30 years of new music since I started the show. And I'm sure that that's an important factor, especially for the two of you.
Yes. I can say that, in general, I tend to play new releases, reissues, and rare things. And thinking about David's question, specifically about how Felix influences us to this day, I would say there are two main approaches to how to program on radio. One is you follow the consultants and their marketing director's approach, which is you eliminate all the tune-out factors. You play it safe. You be as conservative as you can, and you create something that no one can object to. And the other approach is just the opposite. You do something so interesting, so fascinating, so rare, so unique, that people will be drawn to you. Obviously, you can see where I'm heading. Felix embodied the latter approach. His program, you'll notice, he doesn't use the word jazz in the title of his program. It's the album sound. He had a much wider vision for what he wanted to do on the air. The fact that he's not only playing Brazilian music, he was among the very first to start playing reggae music on the air. He would play blues. He would play fusion. These are the kind of things that consultants say, no, 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 you don't want to confuse the audience. The audience needs to have the same thing rammed down their throat. Felix used his sense of taste. He followed his own interests. He had a much wider interest than many of the people in the advertising department. So you talk about an identity. My feelings about Felix is that he had a very broad vision for what music was about and what he wanted to communicate. And when you listen to his program, you listen to his announcements and even the interviews, there's a narrative there. He's actually telling a story with the songs that he's playing. And it's fascinating. If you were to listen not just over the course of an evening, but over the course of years, that's the story of Felix Grant. And what a fascinating vision he had of music, and how much of that music he shared with his audience is one of the things that I think inspires all of us to this day.
Well, on that subject, I want to play for you all an excerpt of Felix having a conversation with the Brazilian composer and performer Dorival Caymmi. And this is from 1970, I believe, and I would like to speak briefly about Felix's involvement with Brazilian music, and I know you have some insights about that. We talked about it the other day, but let's hear this little excerpt first.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Dorival Caymmi to Washington, D.C., and WMAL at the same time.
Muito prazer, muito boa noite, e muito obrigado.
Infelizmente, não é possível de falar em português com você. So we've got a... How in the world Brazilian music with its gentleness ever traveled along as well? You know, I just can't quite understand. It's something, I guess, that nobody can explain.
São fases, né? No mundo inteiro. Porque é uma fase, né? Me parece que houve uma fase em que se dançava mais.
He believes that maybe it's the fact that before people were a lot more concerned with the dancing music, and now maybe just with the music itself.
That's right. As a matter of fact, when the music began to become very popular here in the United States, many, many people called and said, where can I go and learn how to dance to this? Uh-huh. I said, well, you don't dance to this. You sit around and you enjoy it. It's a very intimate kind of music, actually, without intimacy. It's an intimate kind of music, and it's marvelous to sit and listen to. And, of course, one thing that makes it stand out very much above some of the music that I'll call, again, the very, very obvious popular music, is the great degree of the of musicianship of the people who play guitars.
Larry, you had, as I understand, you took a trip to Brazil with Felix Grant, is that right?
Well, we actually didn't go together.
Uh-huh.
Here's how it went. Felix had been going to Brazil, I think, almost every year since the early 1960s. Yeah. And in fact, I it may have been mentioned, but Felix really helped introduce a lot of Washington listeners to Brazilian music. And not just bossa nova, although he was instrumental in doing that as well. I think that's one of the reasons why the country of Brazil awarded him their highest honor, the Order of the Southern Cross. It's for this voice he had on the airwaves to popularize Brazilian music. So, to tell you that story of the trip, in 1987, I decided I couldn't resist the music anymore. I really wanted to go listen to samba. And I decided to go down for carnival. And I bumped into Felix, and I was excited about it, and I said, hey, I'm going down to Rio, because I know he had gone to Rio so many times, and I wanted some tips, some suggestions. And this speaks to how generous Felix was. He says, oh, I'm going to be staying at this hotel. You must contact me when you're down there. So I get down there. I contact him. He just opened all the doors. He says, meet me at my hotel. At this time, we go. He takes me to a party, introduces me to basically everybody there on the scene. Broadcasters, journalists, musicians. He knew everybody. And I was just so taken with his generosity. And he was very special in that way. He taught himself to speak Portuguese. He is somebody who I learned how to pronounce names from listening to his program.
Yes, very important.
Yeah. So I just think that his love and dedication for not just bossa nova and not just for Brazilian music, he did the same thing for reggae music and the music of Jamaica. I believe that he was playing Brazilian music starting around 1957. Judy and I were talking about this. This is even before João Gilberto had made his very famous recordings in July of 58, which supposedly was the birth of bossa nova, Chega de Saudade and Desafinado and those. So he was playing Luiz Bonfá a year before that. He starts, he actually made his first trip in 1961. Pick up the microphone. As part of a media group?
A media group. He was invited, as I was telling you before, João Santos, who was part of the International Coffee Agreement, was in Washington and introduced him to his brother, Paulo Santos, who was a radio broadcaster in Brazil. And this is how he initially made that connection. He Paulo Santos brought him some albums. This was in the probably early 60s, and he invited him over there as part of the media group, and that was the first trip that he took, and he was completely just Brazil just took over. I mean, he just really loved the music, loved the people. He said, Americans love music, he said, but Brazilians are crazy about music.
So he brought these recordings back, and he started to play them on the air.
Yes.
And for many of us, this was our first introduction. And this is even before, in 1962, Charlie Bird and Stan Getz make this very famous recording up at All Souls Unitarian Church on 16th Street, the Jazz Samba, which became a hit. Right? This is even before the hit. So Felix, I think, was instrumental for a number of reasons.
He was a pioneer in that way.
Yeah.
I'd like to step in front of you, actually, not trying to be rude, just to pour myself some water. And I want to talk a little bit about interviewing musicians. I know, Larry, you and Rusty do occasional interviews, sometimes on the air. And Rob, I know you do interviews less often. But this conversation is going to be I just want to put this in, throw this into the mix, to think about ways that you need to think of on your feet during these times, and be like a jazz musician and improvise when something is maybe going into a direction that you really didn't expect. I would like to play the next two excerpts on the disc I brought along. One is from an interview in 1978 that Felix Grant did with cornetist Ruby Braff. And the other is with the great organist Jimmy Smith from May of 1983. So we'll hear two cuts.
It says, right on my bulletin board in front of me, Ruby Braff with Felix, Monday, 9 p.m., May 8th, it's 9:05. Welcome, Ruby. Welcome here tonight.
Nice to be here, Felix. Am I close enough to this thing?
I believe you are. Last time you were in this studio, you had an interesting guy along with you. You and George Barnes dropped by one time.
Oh.
And
did you think he was interesting?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny, because you're the only other one beside himself.
That's right. I
thought he was.
Well, I didn't know. I'd like to surprise you with something that I didn't even know. I heard it this afternoon for the first time. Something that just came out. I'm sure you haven't heard this in a long time. People like yourself recognize yourselves immediately, so there's no question that Ruby Braff is part of it. And it's just been reissued as of today. I just reissued one of the earliest records I suppose you were almost on, the thing up in Boston.
Why do they do that?
I don't know. Pee Wee Russell. I suppose it's the people who are involved in the whole sessions as to why that's done.
Oh, it's horrible. I think anyone that puts out that record is a nut.
One thing I love about Ruby, Ruby's not bashful about anything. Ruby says, puts on his mind.
And it's a terrible record. It was a terrible band. It was made in a terrible place. And the only thing probably good on it was probably Pee Wee. It's just awful. I even hated it then when I didn't know anything.
I see. Well, that's the very, very early days of Ruby. Do you have any kind of a record collection of your own?
Yeah, do you have any more surprises?
No, that's all. That's the only. They just came out today, Ruby. And
do I have a record collection of my own?
Yeah, do you have?
Of my records?
Yeah, of yours.
Of course not.
No, you don't.
I have a record collection of other people's records.
Now, one person you admired greatly was Bobby Hackett. I know we had talked about Bobby.
Oh, sure.
One of the nicest, gentlest humans, I suppose, in the world.
Yes, and Bobby Hackett did great things for me. I remember that when two guys were beating me up and killing me, he walked by and said, "That's enough, fellas." You know, he was very nice.
Ruby Braff has dropped by to lend a little lightness to the air here tonight.
In the next cut.
Now, this is just a portion of a very new album of Jimmy Smith's, and the title of the album, it's off the top, and it's one of the originals of Jimmy.
Yeah, that's my original tune, the first tune.
Super, super group along with you, though. That's Stanley. It's unfortunate to mention anyone first. No matter, you're implying.
Yeah, you gotta kind of watch it.
Sometimes when I run into this kind of thing, I'll say in an alphabetical order. Yeah. Kind of do it that way, and then you're not putting anybody.
Well, you gotta kind of watch when you talk about whoever's first and who's second, you know, because all these are giants. We are all giants.
And they've all had their own sessions and their own groups.
Of course. But this particular session that I had here, we went in this session with no rehearsal. No rehearsal at all. None whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Sat down and played. Mm-hmm. That's all. It's just one of those once-in-a-lifetime things, you know. You know, most people, you know, like the rock groups, they got to rehearse for 5 months before they put an album out. Of course, they get a gold album, platinum album when they do it, you know.
Yeah.
Because jazz people, we don't get platinums, you know. They don't get platinum albums to jazz people. I don't know why. Yeah. But it's about damn time you give us some platinum albums, you know what I mean? I'm telling you people out there in jazz.
Yeah, especially
give the jazz market people some platinum albums. In fact, I would like to make this album a platinum album. Because I got some giant players there.
I don't blame you, Jimmy. Know. I'm on your side.
Let's give it to jazz people. You know, they're supporting all these rock juice. What do you got? The punk rock. You know, all these people painting their hair yellow and red and purple. You know, We still got our hair the same color, so give us first and then get them painted folks next, you know what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
Let them painted folks have it next.
Yeah. Well, we'll hope that the people will go down.
Here first.
Yeah, I hope people will go to the cool festival over the weekend. Maybe you can lay a little about
See, what I'm trying to tell the people, if they don't come to the festival, I'm going to break in the house. I'm going to break in the homes. Mm-hmm. I threaten people.
You do.
I threaten people. That's why the Blues Alley was so crowded down there. I said, I'm going to break in your home if you don't come hear me.
My guest here, just so you'll get his name right and spell it right, his name is Jimmy Smith. And Jimmy's in town, was in town, played all last week.
So, conducting interviews on the air. Rob, I know you had a very different experience with Ruby Braff on the air. And I could see that we were kind of straining to hear the comment he made back here. It's a little hard to hear behind the speakers, but the anecdote about Bobby Hackett was Felix said Bobby Hackett was this kind and wonderful, gentle human being. He says, oh yeah, years ago when some guys were beating me up and killing me, Bobby Hackett walked by and said, that's enough, fellas.
I did interview Ruby, and as David said, I've done far fewer interviews than Larry and Rusty for a number of reasons. But I think the opportunity to interview Ruby was prospectively only the second time I would ever do an interview, and it was because of Elliot Epstein, who had the Club Cates, and I didn't want to turn Elliot down. But I did know that Ruby looked upon radio interviewers as chewing tobacco with legs. And I did check with my attorney that afternoon to be sure all my affairs were in order. And David has listened to the interview far more recently than I have. And I think maybe Ruby sensed my vulnerability because I was really scared. But it did come off. He was lovely. He was funny.
Yes.
He was charming. And he told Elliot afterwards that he was very, very pleased with the entire experience, which I don't know how much of that was accident or how much of that I can claim any responsibility for, but apparently one of the things that I did was I just didn't ask the same tired questions that he had heard, and I tacked a different path. And he was really quite funny. There was one point where I played a track, and he said something to the effect of, gosh, he said, I didn't know I knew that song. I'd been meaning to learn it, but now I don't have to.
Well, I've just been informed that we're starting, the sand is starting to run out. Rusty, I'd like for you to comment on this in lieu of taking questions. We're just going to go until they tell us to. Oh, then I got 10 minutes.
Great. So. Well, I've been really blessed not to run into the difficult rascalian type people like Ruby Braff, but the most difficult person I ever interviewed was Washingtonian Buck Hill. And because Buck is so quiet, it's easy to get him to talk and pull words out of him and stuff like that. But if you ask questions, particularly if you do your homework and know about where he went to high school and the fact that he had the same teacher as Duke Ellington and stuff like that, he will open up, you know, but it's hard. I mean, it's more of a laying out the elaborate question to get the yes answer or something like that with Buck. But I'll never forget one morning on WDCU going to work or just listening to the radio, hearing Fournet interview Jimmy Smith. And it was like I really felt for her, you know, because he was rude. You know, it was really difficult. She was trying to bring in callers and stuff like that. And it's that kind of a person that you really have to turn it around to bring out the best in them, and that's very difficult. And you can hear Felix doing that. You can hear that way of sort of changing the topic, trying to get to the soft spot in the artist and stuff like that. And you could see he handled it very professionally, and that was the real skill that he had in that turning it around from a difficult point. And you wonder if they had those buttons for obscenities back then.
Larry? Or Bill?
The one thing I noticed just from listening to these excerpts and my memories of his interviews is that They're conversations. It's not just, you know, so many people just sort of phone it in. They read prepared questions, and instead of listening to the answer, they'll be looking at their piece of paper for the next question. Felix knew it was about conversation. It was about communication. But Felix was also so hip that he established credibility with the artist right away. Even when you're meeting somebody for the first time, you have that first 10 or 15 seconds, and the artist will figure out from the first question whether it's going to go downhill or not. And Felix just knew how to open up the door to communication, and so that the artist felt comfortable, they would start to tell stories. Felix would show that he was, like, with it, that he would ask informed questions.
Ruby Braff notwithstanding.
And that would even bring out, you know, different sides, different aspects, different facets to these artists. But I'm curious your thoughts.
Everybody's answered my thought. The thought was that you absolutely must listen to the answer, and from that answer, you form your next question. You have to do your homework. You have to do your research on them. And I had a voice teacher that said to me, Bill, just pay attention to what someone says to you and be smart enough to give a decent answer back. And I said, Louie, I'm not smart enough. He says, oh, yes, you are. You'll do fine. And I agree with that, what everyone here on the panel has said. We're so darn lucky to have been in a business that allowed us to meet these talented people who were willing to share their thoughts with us. And I loved it. I'd do it again in a minute. Somebody said to me, well, go to Sirius or XM. And I said, well, they won't let me be Bill Mayhew at XM. I did go over there, and I talked to a man named Hugh Panero, and I played some tapes of mine, and I said, what do you think? He says, well, you can't do that here on XM. I said, I can't? He said, oh, no. No, we have 50 talk channels and we have 50 music channels. All you'll be able to talk about are the other 49 music channels. And I said, well, in 2 weeks I'd hate myself. And that scared me. Now, maybe that has changed. I don't know. I don't listen to Sirius or XM. I've got a marvelous CD player in my car. And except for getting a traffic report, I usually play whatever's in the car. I have 10,000 33 and a third albums in my home and probably 5,000 or 6,000 CDs. And I asked my wife, I said, honey, when I die, what do you think we ought to do with that? She said, do it ahead of time.
Wow. Well, I was hoping to do a lot, to go into a lot more places with this conversation than the time has permitted. I always overplan for these things, but that's just my way. But one of the areas was to talk about where we see jazz on radio going, and will there be a jazz radio host in the future? What do you think?
Yes. But actually, I wanted to add something previously, just before I forget. One of the great things about Felix is that he had passion for this music. He was a professional. He was a consummate professional. But he loved music. And I'll never forget being in my car, listening to an interview he did with Art Pepper right after Art's autobiography had come out. It's a rather harrowing story. And you could hear it in Felix's voice. He was, I won't say he's like a little kid, but he was getting excited talking about the Stan Kenton days or talking about Art's records for Contemporary or any of that. And you could feel this, and it's kind of contagious. And here's a man who was on the air 5 nights a week for 4 hours a night, and he was still excited about music. His life was music. And you realize, oh, okay, being obsessed about music is not just for kids. So that's one of the things that I will always remember.
I think we all share that. I just want to really echo Bill's comment that we as broadcasters have really been blessed to be able to meet and talk to our heroes. You know, we're not musicians. We don't play an instrument. But we have such a passion about the music that we want to share it with others. And so we do it on the airwaves, in the classroom, wherever we can. Some of us are even blessed with day jobs that do that type of thing. Unfortunately, mine is totally unrelated to it. But I've been really blessed to be on the air from the 60s and interviewing all these remarkable musicians, many of whom have passed on, but we still do it. We're really blessed in this town having two stations that present jazz, WAMU, keeping Rob on the air through all the changes that they've done over the years, and WPFW, where we have to go on endless begging things every couple of months or whatever, but we really count on you listeners to support the station to keep it going so we have that avenue. With the changes in technology, of course, now people all over the world can hear us on the internet. I was wondering who my host was when I was up in Connecticut last weekend, and it was 10 after 10. I said, oh, geez, I could have listened on my brother's computer to find out, you know? It's that kind of outreach that we do have with the new technology that's dramatically changing music, dramatically changing how people get their recordings. You know, my grandson's teaching me how to download stuff that I don't have a clue of what I'm doing. But again, it's the CDs that we play, the LPs that we pull out, and everything like that is the lifeblood of this organization. And I'm really, really pleased to be a part of this panel.
Rob?
I have survived a number of purges. But as I said to one of our former program directors, when you're on 3 hours out of a total of 168, you don't tug on Superman's cape. I would say that one of the greatest influences upon me, because I knew Felix the least of the other individuals on the panel, the thing that I learned from Felix and from Bill, whose program was salve to soothe fits of insomnia, is that radio is a companionable medium. And I think one of the enormous losses has been that so little radio is companionable anymore. And Larry, Rusty, and I do have this extraordinary opportunity that makes me feel quite humble that we get to fill hours of ether without the interference, without the focus groups that Larry alluded to earlier. Let me close my remarks with just one anecdote. When Louis Belson died, I think did two or maybe even 3 hour remembrance of him, even though he sort of gets a little bit out of my domain in his later years. And I got an email from a listener, and I'm sure Larry and Rusty have listeners that they're snipers. They're snipers. They're always out there. And he wrote, well, I've had enough of this noise, and he's leaving. And I wrote him back, and I quoted a different former program director, and I said, well, Don, I'll see you next week. But as a former program director of mine once said, if you please everyone all of the time, you can't be doing anything really important. And he wrote back and interpreted this narcissistically and alluded to a wonderful host at WFUV, Rich Connolly, who has stayed pretty much on the same path, and he says what Rich does is important. But subsequent to that program, I had emails from 5 or 6 people. Two or three of them had crossed paths with Louis Belson, had wonderful stories to tell. These people were touched, or the program, the tribute to Belson, resonated for them. And that's the point. Those three people who called you, Rusty, after you played Coleman and Coltrane back-to-back, maybe three people who hadn't been reached, but were reached by virtue of what you did. And so no matter how thin-skinned we may be as hosts, it is important to accept the fact that if you do please all of the people all of the time, maybe we're really not meeting our mission.
Wow. Thank you, Rob. I just want to remind you all to please phone in during fundraiser time, during your favorite musical program.
And I want to thank you all, Rob and Rusty, Mike, Judith, Larry, Bill Mayhew. Yeah. Thank you all very much for doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you, Roberta.